Morning's talk on Wednesday. I said last night I'd answer one of the questions which someone put in the question box last night about the jhanas and stages of enlightenment, how they all fit together, what the meaning is of these things, and also a little bit more instructions on how to experience some of these things. So today's talk is about jhanas and their relevance and how to achieve them. And if ever in British tradition, if ever I get a coat of arms, my motto would be from the Dharmapada, one of my favourite phrases, which is Nati Jhanan Apanyasa Panya Natiya Jayato Yamhi Jhanan Chapanya Cha Sawe Nibbana Santike, which you all know means that there is no jhana without wisdom. There is no wisdom without jhana. But in the one who has both jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. And the very beautiful saying, straight from the Dharmapada, verse 372, I even know the number of it from memory, because what it's actually saying is that you can't just get into these jhanas just through force or through willpower or through striving. You have to use wisdom, you have to use insight. The word for insight, panya, sometimes people know it better in Sanskrit, pranya. This is like the result of insight, the result of seeing clearly, the result of looking at, understanding and overcoming the obstacles to deep meditation. Or putting it in another way, looking at understanding and overcoming the defilements, or the attachments, or the cravings, or the clingings, whatever else you call those obstacles which stop you enjoying meditation at a deeper level. And that insight is just so important to gain those jhanas. That's why the first line is, without that insight, there is no jhanas. And the second line is, without jhanas, there's no insight. It seems like it's a double bind. You can't get one without the other. But there are different types of wisdoms which are being talked about there. First is like the wisdom of the way, of how to get into the jhanas, those little defilements and cravings which block you. And the second one is, there's no insight without the jhanas. It means that you have that strong mind state which is free from the hindrances and any other defilements. So you've got the classic window of opportunity to see the Dharma, to see that which you take as a self, to see the Four Noble Truths, to see life, to see everything clearly, without conditioning, as if for the first time. So that's why you do need those jhanas, to get those great insights. And they say, whoever's got sort of, you know, there's wisdom, understanding and jhanas, now they've got that reasonably good understanding and enough insight so far in the path of jhanas and also into the jhanas themselves, and so they experience those jhanas, then they're knocking at the door of enlightenment. It's only a matter of time. In a sermon which I gave many years ago at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, I used to say that the jhanas are just like the match. And the insight, or the wisdom, is like the gunpowder. If you put those two together, if you've got sort of a match and you've got sort of gunpowder, then sooner or later it's going to be a bang. It's only a matter of a short amount of time. If you've got gunpowder but no match, if you've got a match without gunpowder, nothing's going to blow up. So if you've got wisdom but no real jhanas, if you've got jhanas but no real wisdom, then nothing's going to happen. Or the other simile was, jhanas are like the flashlight, and wisdom is like the map, and the enlightenment is like the treasure. You know, you've got a nice treasure map left by the Buddha. You know, the eight steps, the eightfold path. And at the end of the eightfold path, there's a little cross, and the treasure is buried there. But of course, the people haven't got the flashlight, so they go into this jungle of the mind. And I think you know that's a very good metaphor for this mind. When you start meditating, it's a jungle, and sometimes it's the darkest of jungles in there, and sometimes it's very confusing with vines of defilements and great logs of craving just blocking the way. And sometimes it's almost impenetrable. But you keep on going. But if you've got the mat there, you need a flashlight as well to especially to see the map and also to show the way, because it's pretty dark in there. And if you got the map, you know Four Noble Truths, you know Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, you know dependent origination, you know emptiness, you know all of these things, you can recite the whole of the Sutta Pitaka off by heart backwards. Even if you can do that, if you haven't got the flashlight, you've got a wonderful map, but you don't know how to use it. So the map is that sort of wisdom, the understanding of the Buddha's teaching. The flashlight is the jhanas. And it's a very good simile, because after you get into deep meditation, the mind gets really bright. And I've already intimated some of the results of those very bright mind states, because you go outside, you look at a leaf, wow, you can see it deeply. It's as if you've got a big flashlight and you're shining it on something and you can actually see what it truly is. You know what it's like at night time? You go outside, you can see sort of the silhouette of the tree, sort of its shape. Sometimes an animal, like a cat, which is walking through the garden, you can't really see it clearly what it exactly is. Certainly you can't see what its colour is. You can sort of see its shape. If you get a flashlight out and you point it at the cake, that you see exactly what it is. So the usual mind state is like that. It's like a mind in darkness. All you can see is silhouettes, sort of shapes of what the mind is, what thoughts are, what defilements is, what truth is, what happiness is. It's sort of a bit murky. But once you get the jhanas up, and after the jhanas, the mind is so powerful, it's like putting 7 or 8 batteries in your flashlight. New ones, powerful ones. You turn on the flashlight and wow, everyone can see it. And so once you get these states of mind, you actually experience the mind is just so much more powerful. Whatever you look at, whether it's a carpet, or whether it's a mind, or whether it's the Four Noble Truths, you can really see deeply into that and find out what it truly is. So that's why they say that, you know, if you've got both of those together, you're in the presence of Nirvana. Something's going to happen pretty soon, whether you like it or not. So the reason why people don't get enlightened is because they don't have enough deep meditation, and secondly, they don't have enough good instructions and wisdom teachings and get that insight coming up along the way. So when you have these two together, then you're really getting somewhere. But to get these states of mind, these deep jhanas, and again, it's a very good way of knowing where you are, because if you start to try and see where you are on the path of insight, how much you understand, how much you know, sometimes it's just too difficult to assess your progress. Because everyone thinks they're wise. Everyone thinks they know. So the point is that the problem with ignorance, with not seeing, is that we never know that we don't know. It's like the simile of this monk I knew who was a Vietnam War veteran. He fought as a US Marine in Vietnam. And he was shot in the back of the head in Vietnam. And he had to have some of his brain removed. And the doctors told him as a Marine that he was going, when he was in hospital with the bandages on, he was going to be blind, he would never see anymore. Because the part of the brain which was injured was that part which is associated with sight. And I remember him talking about his experiences. In the hospital he thought, okay, you know, if I can't see, I'm going to commit suicide at the first opportunity. He was a very tough guy and he wanted to live life, and he didn't want to live life as a blind man. But when they took the bandages off, it surprised the doctors, it surprised him, he could actually see. You know, for some reason or other, he'd survived. And that gave him tremendous high, that closeness to death and to suicide and to depression, and then coming to life again, taught him a bit of Dharma and he eventually became a monk. But remember him telling me once that he thought he was completely okay with his sight, and then one day he was playing baseball, like, you know, US people do. And one of his mates hit the ball high in the air in his direction, and so he went to catch it. It was an easy catch. And then he followed the ball with his eye, and then suddenly it disappeared. It vanished from existence. He couldn't understand what on earth was going on. And then suddenly it came back into existence again. And he realized, you know, from his doctors, he had what's called a blind spot. There's a space in his field of vision which just wasn't there. And that's the only time that he could realize it was a blind spot. When people think of a blind spot, they think it's like a bit of blackness over there. But you can't, it's not blackness, you just can't see what's over there. It's just like a hole in vision, and the perception fills it up with, you know, what it expects to be there. And it's only when something's moving across your field of vision that actually you know there's a blind spot there. The importance of that metaphor was that he never knew the blind spot was there, except with some sort of inference and some sort of wisdom happening. And that's the same with delusion. We never know we're deluded, just we can't see it. It's impossible to see. The only thing we do know is, I was deluded, once you can see that ball disappearing. But at the time, you just simply do not know. And that's the problem with delusion. We all think we're wise. We all think we know. And that's why you argue with each other. But here, that's why it's very hard to assess wisdom. Very hard to assess, are you enlightened, are you not enlightened, by wisdom. Now, do you understand the Four Noble Truths? Hands up if you understand the Four Noble Truths. Come on, you understand the Four Noble Truths, don't you? But do you really understand the Four Noble Truths? You know, we think we do, and we think, no, it's very easy. Read what? Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the path. You've heard so many talks about those things, you've read it in sort of so many books. And what is it you don't understand? There's a blind spot in there, which one cannot see. Because if that blind spot wasn't in there, not only would you be enlightened, you'd be able to sit down on that meditation cushion and just get into jhana just like that. There's a problem there. But we can't see it, and that's a difficulty. But already, that measuring yourself by the progress in deep meditation, how much you can let go, how peaceful you can get, is a much more reliable guide. Because you can confuse yourself on whether you're wise or not. You can't confuse yourself how peaceful you are. That is very easy to test, as to see. So this path of peace is a much more defined path, so you really know how you're going and what's going on. So we make this path towards deep meditation using the breath as our vehicle. And we get to such stages as the beautiful breath, and then we go off into this nimitta world. And again, talking about the jhanas, I want to sort of pick up the practice, the progress at that point. Beautiful breath and nimittas. So you know what to do next. And also you know how this relates to the jhanas and how this relates to insight as well. Because when you let go of the breath and a nimitta appears, what's happening, as I mentioned before, is the mind is manifesting and the five senses, together with the body, are disappearing. The Buddha always talked about six senses. I know there's a film about a year ago called The Sixth Sense, a lot of rubbish, because the sixth sense is the mind. And I can't see really why just this Western world is just so stubborn and always thinks that it knows best and there are only five senses. That sixth sense is the mind. However, because the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching is what most people know, and that's all they know. Sometimes they don't even suspect there's such a thing called the mind. But you've all heard many sort of stories of people whose body has been dead. They haven't been seeing, they haven't been hearing, they haven't been smelling, tasting or touching. But they've been there. They've been aware. They've been sensitive. They've been conscious. And conscious of the mind. And that sort of, I think one of the reasons why people don't accept that, because that really threatens Christianity, Judaism, Islam, about, you know, the body being the center of the world. And something else about rebirth is obvious once you see that the mind is something separate from the body. But this is actually what you're doing in these jhana states. When you let go of that breath, that's the last piece of five sense consciousness. Because what we're doing in settling down these five senses, sitting the body still, so the physical touch is not really bothering us so much, closing our eyes, so sight isn't bothering us, trying to sit in a reasonably quiet place, it doesn't need to be absolutely quiet as long as the sounds aren't changing too much. If as long as the constant hum in the background of the traffic, it doesn't really matter so much. Because the mind turns off from that and shuts down the said store of sound. And hearing and, sorry, smelling and tasting, again, as long as there haven't been beans for breakfast, you know, the smell doesn't change in the room. And as long as you're still, the physical touch starts to disappear. But we have turning off physical touch is also difficult, because we start just by having many of these physical feelings, and then we just choose one, just the physical feeling of the breath. And the reason why the Buddha encouraged people to do breath meditation is because that breath meditation, it takes one physical feeling which starts off being coarse, and the nature of the breath is once you get peaceful, the breath becomes more refined, it works together with you, going deeper and deeper and deeper into turning off the senses. And I think many of you have already experienced this, this very beautiful breath, which is so subtle, it's almost turning off. It's the last little incy-wincy bit of the five senses, which you're focusing on. And if you can just hold that, all the five senses will turn off. And they'll stay turned off. Sometimes they stay turned, but they turn off, and you get worried, what's going on? And they turn on again. You're afraid not to have these five senses happening. For two reasons. One, because it's strange, because you're used to feeling and hearing, especially those two. And when they're taken away from you, you think, this is weird, this is strange. And you feel afraid of the unknown, because we're always attached to our longevity, our health, our safety. And when we're not alert, we feel unsafe. In the same way that when it's dark and you can't see, now you feel, well, I'm not really in control of this situation. There might be all sorts of things lurking out there. Ghosts, tigers, snakes, who knows? So it's the unknown and the uncontrollable which we get afraid of. And that's the fear which will come up at these five stages of the meditation. Unknown, there's also the fear of the powerless. Because when you get into these deeper states of meditation, you know these are extremely powerful, and you wonder whether you can actually handle this. They're powerful just in their awesomeness, but also in their bliss. Because this is you get lots and lots of happiness. And sometimes people are afraid of that degree of happiness because it's strong and you don't know whether you're in charge anymore. Which goes to the deeper level of attachment at these stages, the addiction to being in charge and in control. You know, the last vestiges of being a control freak. Because we always like to call the shots, we always like to be in control. Even if we delegate, we always want to keep the opportunity to interfere at any time. When you get to these stages, you just cannot interfere. You really have to let go, you really have to delegate, you really have to give up your authority. And that's very hard for many people to do. It is attachment to the self. It's a very powerful part of Buddhism, this idea of non-self. This is where you meet it, head on. You've got a choice. You can either understand that attachment, that illusion, that I am the knower, I am the doer, I am in charge. This is all my job, my business. I'm not going to let go. If you understand it that way, you'll never get any further. But the nice part of these stages of meditation is when you get close, you can actually almost see a few meters in front of you. You can see what's going to happen if you do let go. And you see that's going to be very wonderful, they're very beautiful, that's very lovely. It's just very enticing, the next stage. This is only a metaphor. I'm not saying that you can actually see it as if, now I'm seeing you over there in the distance. You actually feel it, you know it intuitively, that one more step and it's going to be good. But eventually, that's the intuition. One more step is really going to be good, will overcome your fears. You keep getting to the boundary as often as you can, as often as you can, as often as you can. You get to the boundary as if you look in the doorway. And after a while, the doorway, looking through the doorway, inside looks so nice, so nice, so nice, you make that step. When you make that step into the nimitta, that's the first stage of when the five senses start to disappear. And the insight there comes that these five senses are me. I am not sight, I am not the one who sees, I am not hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. These are just part of nature, they come and they go. If you can get into that realm of nimitta long enough, you become much more dispassionate to the world of sights, sounds, smells, taste and touch. You don't care so much what you eat, you don't care so much what you see, beauty, ugliness. You don't care so much about what you hear. People praise you, people call you an idiot, whatever. Because this is just sound, this is something deeper than this. This is not the most important part of your existence. You have something much more important than that. But when you get to the realm of the nimitta, a lot of detachment starts to happen quite naturally. Also, when you get to the realm of nimittas, you know, that you notice, usually afterwards, that this is extremely pleasant. Again, much more pleasant than the most delicious food, the best sex, the best wines, the best music, the best movies, the best anything, which is on offer. And also, you don't have to pay for it. And you don't even need to be healthy. You can be on your deathbed and dying in great pain. And you can just go straight in there if you're really wise. And you don't need to be a man or a woman or Asian or Westerner or Aboriginal. It's just all that sort of stuff. Gender and race, age, that's all to do with the body. It's just leaving all that aside and going to the mind. One of the things you do notice also when you go to the mind, that mind is beyond gender. So when you get to that mind, the male mind, the female mind, the Singaporean mind, the Aussie mind, the Kiwi mind, it's all the same. You go into actually what's at the heart of it. But not only that, but not just the human mind, the animal mind, the insect mind, the deva mind, the ghost mind. You go to that which is central to all beings. This is where you can really start to understand and relate to all sorts of beings you could relate to before. So when you get to this stage of the meditation, you're getting a heck of a lot of insights into the nature of life, impermanence, non-self, suffering and happiness, Four Noble Truths, five khandhas, the aggregates of being. You get to really deep knowledge already, just getting that much. But of course, it's a little bit further to go, because when a person first gets these nimittas, I mean, they're very hard to handle and to actually to maintain. Usually the first time they come up, they're bright, they move all over the place. Sometimes the people get those firework nimittas, which is interesting, but it's nowhere near good enough. If that nimitta is not soft enough to stay, not bright enough to grab your attention, then basically you should go back to the beautiful breath and just leave that nimitta alone. Because it's only the really good nimittas which will really take you deeper. And the way to know a good nimitta is two qualities to it. It's stability and it's beauty. You can translate beauty into brightness, into joyfulness, into happiness associated with that state. And the stability is it's not moving, or hardly moving at all. And out of those two, it's good to know the causes to increase the stability, to increase the brightness. The causes are as follows. The stability of the nimitta is very much how long you spend with a beautiful breath. If you just go quickly through the beautiful breath onto a nimitta, you find it's all over the place. Because you haven't settled the mind down, you haven't developed what's called samadhi in the sense of the ability to sustain attention on something very refined. Now you have to learn how to sustain your attention on the very refined, beautiful breath first of all. If you can't do that and you get something even more refined, there's no way in the world you're going to hold that. It's going to slip from you. You haven't got the sensitivity, you know, too hard, too soft, the way you're grasping things. And if it's too hard, you squash it. If it's too soft, it slips from you. It's just like holding a flower. You know, if a person's just been laying bricks and they go and hold a flower, you know, it's they grasp it too hard and they squash the poor thing, or they're, you know, too soft and it just slips from their grasp. The sensitivity is not there. So if you've been laying bricks, then just rest the hand and go, have a cup of tea first of all, pick up a cup of tea, and then sort of pick up a book or pick up a piece of paper, get that sensitivity back. So you go into more and more refined stages. So if that nimitta keeps moving backwards and forwards, the advice will always be go back to the beautiful breath and keep training the ability to sustain attention on something very refined until you can hold that beautiful breath just so easily. And that beautiful breath does not change. It just stays there, extremely nice feeling, but it's the breath, you know it's the breath, and it stays there, hardly changes, very easy, and you're very happy and content just doing that. And then if you turn to a nimitta, when the nimitta comes, that also is still. The other part of stabilizing the nimitta is to, I've said this before, that nimitta, what it actually is, is a reflection of your mind. It actually is as if you've got a mirror of this mindfulness, not in front of the five senses anymore, but in front of the mind, released from the five senses. That's why in the sutras they say that pabhasaram chitang, that this mind is radiant. And this is what you're actually seeing, the radiant mind. That's what it looks like. But if you are moving, the watcher is moving, so does the nimitta. So the other way of calming down the mind, if you've been watching the beautiful breath, then take away, as it were, the effort from the object, put some effort into the knower, to be still. The simile of looking your face in the mirror in the morning, if that face is moving, you can hold the mirror as tightly as you can, it won't stop the image moving. It's not the mirror's fault, it's the person who's watching. So the person who's watching in this state has to be very still. This is why it's difficult, because the only way to make it still is to have some trust, some confidence, that you don't have to do anything. You have to have the same sort of confidence as a baby has in its mother. And, you know, I've seen this many times, you've probably done this with your children. You take the baby to the shops, and now you're carrying it in your arm or whatever, and that baby has so much confidence in you that it goes completely to sleep. It just knows you will not drop it. Now imagine sort of now doing that now. You know, you sort of, you know, you put yourself in the arms of one of these big men in this room. Would you really be able to fall asleep? No way, they're going to drop you for sure. I'm sure they're going to drop me. So you have to have that sort of confidence to know that everything's going to be okay. You don't have to do anything. You can really relax and let go. And basically just let go of the doer. Then this is where confidence is very good. That's why again, one of the skillful techniques which I developed and I teach to the monks at Serpentine, if an nimitta comes up, and it's up there and it's not sort of, you know, being all that still, sort of give confidence to that nimitta. As if, you know, it's a good friend of theirs, look, I trust you. I give you the keys to my car, I give you the steering wheel, take over. Completely. And by saying those words, or giving that confidence to the nimitta, very often you stop and the nimitta stops. Because that nimitta is just the observer, seen through a mirror. You're actually giving trust. Giving trust is another way of letting go. If you're very, you don't give your trust up very easily, it's hard to let go. You give your trust up to the nimitta. And you completely let go. Then it stabilizes, it's still. Sometimes that's not enough to get into the deeper jhana, because the other part which you have to do is to brighten up that nimitta, so it's very bright and very beautiful. The cause of the beauty of the nimitta is just the energy of the mind. And that energy of the mind, I'm not talking about caffeinated minds, I'm talking about the energy of purity, of beauty, of inspiration, the piti-sukha part of it. And if you've done lots of good karma, if you've been very generous, you've hung around temples, you've served on Buddhist society committees, now, I'm not making a joke here, this is serious. If you've got lots of good karma there, that's going to brighten up your mind. If you've just been one of these people who just hangs about the Buddhist society and sort of hardly ever puts a donation in the box, hardly ever goes and gives any dana, any food to the monks or the nuns, and doesn't really sort of help with the busy bees or the serving on the committee, there's a dryness there. And that will come out when you get to the nimitta stage. Your nimitta won't be very bright. Good karma, basically. If you've been practicing precepts, I mean properly practicing them, and you've got a very pure mind, when that nimitta comes up, that's going to be very beautiful. Because it shows you just what you've been doing all these years. There's a certain amount of honesty and truth comes at these stages. You find out what you've been doing. So remember those things, because that's why all this, the practicing generosity and keeping precepts and service and compassion, that's why it's incredibly important to the path. That's why it's part of the Eightfold Path. And you can't really bypass that. And you actually see that and you get the payoff. As far as enlightenment is concerned, at this stage, the nimitta is beautiful because you've got a beautiful mind. If you've done sort of mistakes and you haven't been very pure in your conduct, then that nimitta is going to be dusty and rusty and just dirty and not very bright. In fact, if you get to that stage. So remember, it's the purity of your conduct, and that inspires you to sort of be a bit more beautiful and get more inspiration. And the fast way to try and overcome that, I've been trying to teach here, the perception of the beautiful. Yeah. Forget all of your past and just look at the beautiful and get inspired, have that positive attitude. And that sort of whatever beauty is in that nimitta, you can actually pick it out. If you've got very pure mind and very sort of high-minded person, that beauty is just so strong anyway, you can't miss it. It's like a flower. You know, there's just an incredible amount of beauty in there. But if you've only got sort of a weed or a blade of grass, you've got to work a bit harder with the perception of the beauty. But you can get it out. And like a flower, like a blade of grass, you've got to go right into its center, which is the other way of developing that sort of shining nimitta, the beautiful nimitta. Whatever beauty comes up, go in the middle of it. And it's always the most beautiful part there. So you remember these two things, how to work with the nimittas, stability and beauty. And if you get those two things together, then that nimitta will absolutely stay there. It'll become brighter and brighter and brighter the longer you stay there. This is not the jhana yet, but you're right on the edge. And also, just to get to those stages, you've been working with the nimittas, you've got heaps and heaps of insight on what you've had to do to get to that stage. To get to that stage is not without wisdom and insights. You have to have all these insights into what that nimitta is, how to keep it still, why it's moving, why it's dull, why it's bright, what the meaning of precepts are, what the meaning of generosity is, what the meaning of purity is. These are experiences, and you're getting all the science there. You've also got the two big upakalesas. Upakalesas means like the last of these defilements, which I was talking about a little bit earlier. The fear and the excitement. Again, the Lord Buddha's teaching on meditation is the very best. He gave this whole sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Upakalesa Sutta, on these last barriers before you get into the jhanas. They're there in the suttas, but hardly anyone ever talks about them. And the biggest ones are the fear and the excitement. Again, even at that stage, you've got this beautiful nimitta over here. To go into the next stage, you have to let go of another level of doing. Because there, I mean, you're still, but you decided to be still. It's as if it's a choice to be still. Go a little bit further, that choice to be still is gone. As if you turned off the switches, but your finger's still on the switch. Now you're going to take the finger away. So the switch is just not within your reach anymore when you get into a jhana. And that's scary. If you want to say how scary that is, I remember in some of the films, which I used to see as a kid, the scariest thing was, because it was Christian tradition, was when the devil came up and came to take over your soul. I've come to take over your soul. And they have lots of these traditions, like even Goethe's Faust. Those of you who know that sort of that story, that book. And this whole predicated on the idea that a person's got a soul, and this guy, Dr. Faustus, he sells his soul to the devil to get some wisdom. Now, I've got enough wisdom now. If the devil came along and said, Ajahn Brahm, I'll give you, say, $1 million for your soul, and you can use $1 million to build an Ajahn monastery, I said, deal. Because I know there's nothing in here. So that devil's getting a pretty raw deal. He's just getting a fantasy. Nothing. But for many people, that's really scary, isn't it? To give up you. You give up many other things. You give up, you know, your generosity. You can give up your house. You can even become a monk or a nun. You give up everything. But can you give up you? That's why Ajahn Chah used to keep asking the monks. He said, have you come here to die? No, I come here to be a monk. No, I come here to die. You, that Brahmavamsa, that's got to die. The self has got to completely go. Uh-oh, maybe I won't become a monk after all. Because that gets very scary. We're giving up everything to get into these jhanas. And this is where you start to learn about letting go. You can let go of a few things as long as it's comfortable. It's like, you know, if you are giving a donation to the Buddhist Society or to some charity, before you give a donation, you say, can I afford this? Have I got enough left for me and my kids and my family and my mortgage and my holiday and my retirement pension and my this and my that? Can I really afford it? But here, can afford it or not, you give your whole bank book and whole bank balance and your house and your family, you give anything. That's why it's very scary at this stage. The nice thing about it is you might have to give this, but it will come back to you afterwards. You don't have to worry about it. No one really takes it away, but you're giving it. So it's that ability to really let go. And that tests how much wisdom you have, how much confidence you have, and also how much guts you have, actually, to get into those jhanas. And that's why a lot of people, they get to the edge, but they can't go further. They just haven't got the guts, the courage, basically the rebelliousness to give it a go. If you're one of those persons who's always in your life and have been adventurous, now taking on tasks which, you know, people say are beyond you, but you could give it a go anyway, doing things which people say is impossible, I'm going to show you. If that's the sort of person, then if you get to that stage, you've got a really good chance of going all the way. So that's the fear part, that's a big one. The other one is the excitement, because especially when monks like me keep talking about these jhanas again and again and again, and when you get close, say, at last! Wow! And I must note this down, put it on my computer so I can tell my friends. Be careful, you've lost it. That Simile of Ajahn Chah, the still forest bull, sitting very quietly there, and the most beautiful animal you've ever seen in your whole existence suddenly comes out. Wow! And it never comes out again for years. You've blown it. You said, wow, it has hurt you. You're not ready yet. Not years, you know, sometimes only days or weeks or months, but sometimes years. So you have to be very careful. These states are born of silence. Do not interrupt that silence. Enlightenment's coming, and you're sending it away again. So be careful there. So those are the two ones to really watch out for. The wow response and the response, fear and excitement. There's a few other little things there, but I've already really covered them about brightening the mimetic and carving it down. But if you overcome those responses and just basically do nothing and absolutely still and willing to let go of the whole caboose, then the next thing which happens is you just find yourself falling into that mimetic and just all the mimetic coming towards you. Sometimes that happens to people, and again, wow, or afraid, as if you bounce out, it's a ping pong jhana. Not really a jhana. You sort of go in and you come back out again. Again, you're not ready. So they'll be very close. And those ping pong jhanas are really amazing, just that much. And you come out afterwards, wow, it's the best experience of my life, even if it's only a second. At least you're getting a taste of what these things are all about. And it's a great religious experience for you. And you'll never be able to forget it for the rest of your life. And you'll always remember it in the most significant spiritual event of your lifetime. Just even that ping pong jar. But if you can actually just let go and just allow the mind just to get sucked in, because that's the nature of these things, become so beautiful that draws the mind in. It's a magnet effect. And then you go into one of the jhanas. If it's the first jhana, it's, and again, the mind is not absolutely still. It's almost like a pulsating, what I call a wobble of the mind. Again, a few things I should say about these days, because you're all probably thinking, was that a jhana which I had? Always trying to assess and trying to sort of, you know, give yourself the benefit of the doubt so you can get a bit higher. So be careful about that. One of the things which you should know, in these jhanas, absolutely no physical feeling. The body is completely gone. No sound. You can't hear anything. Absolutely no thoughts. Can't think. You can't say. You can't take a note. You're silent. And it's effortless. You're not doing anything. You're really just watching. So if you can hear something, no way that's a jhana. If you can still feel the body, that's not a jhana. If it only lasts for a second, it's not really a jhana. I call it a ping pong jhana. But it's not real jhana. It's just a name. The jhana has to be sustained. Because when you get into those places, they last a long time. Because once you're actually in those places, the joy just holds the mind still. Holds the attention. As if it's super glue. Now what happens actually in this first jhana, for all it's worth for you, is because again, not you, but the mind isn't so confident about what's going on. It sort of holds that joy a bit too hard. It's just that holding a touch too hard sort of disturbs the state. And you know, what we look upon as mindfulness just recedes a little bit. But then the bliss is so much, it just goes straight back in again. And you've got this little wobble here. For those of you who've ever read the descriptions of the jhanas, that's called in Pali vitakka vichara. It's the most refined, almost primordial type of doing you could possibly imagine. It's the first type of doing which you start to move towards an object, or you start to hold on to it. It's that sort of doing. Very much pre-verbal. Almost subliminal or subconscious. But it's there, just a movement which stops the mind being completely still. But still you're blissed out and you stay in those states for long periods of time. But there's still a little bit of a wobble there. That wobble gives the mind a little bit of width. But if you get rid of that wobble, sometimes when you go into jhana you just go straight through that wobble into what's called a second jhana. Or sometimes you stay in the wobble and then after a while the mind realizes what the disturbance is and it just goes deeper. And when that wobble disappears, it's as if the mind actually gives confidence to the full confidence to the experience. That's why you actually see that written in the Pali, the sampasadhaniyam, ajatam sampasadhaniyam, the full confidence in the internal experience. When that actually happens, you realize the mind realizes it doesn't have to hold on to anything anymore. And that means, because it doesn't hold on, the mind doesn't recede. And that's absolute stillness. Now each of these stages is very weird. By absolute stillness, this means you cannot formulate any movement of the mind at all. Which is why when people actually get into those states, they're like rocks. They're blissed out of their little heads, but they're just absolutely still and they cannot move. And it's just, obviously time is standing still, but they can't come out. They're absolutely stuck. And they're very happy to be stuck, because they're having a great time. And if you come out from one of those stages, that's actually one of the hallmarks of the second jhanas and above. It's absolutely motionless. And if you want to talk about non-duality, duality means two. It has to be some movement, some space there for duality. There's no space here at all. You talk about like being at a point. You're at a point and there's no movement. There's no way you can look, because now how can you look when you're at a point? The observer's in a point, everything's in a point. There's no space there at all. All this is just bliss, which lasts and lasts and lasts. But when you come out afterwards, you realize this thing we call doer and willing, choice, this is not essential to being. Because you've been in this place for a long period of time, there's no doing at all, no willing, no choice. You've completely let go of that part of the self called the doer. And not only are you taking your finger off the switch, you bust up the switch, you bust up the finger as well, and it's just not there anymore. And this is actually starts to really, afterwards when you focus on these things, it gives you incredibly powerful data, irrefutable data, which, you know, again, shocks you to the roots, and you see just, you always thought you were the one who did things, you were the one who chose, and choice and will were so essential to you, so much so you would never give up your choice and will to anybody. And the fundamental human right is the right to be free of will. And so we think like the freedom of will. So no government, no husband, no boss at work, no monk, no cult figure, no pope is going to tell me what to do. I might follow what they do, but I will decide whether to follow or not to follow. That freedom of choice, freedom of will, is just so cherished in our society. We hate totalitarian dictatorships, but there's an alternative, which is this no will at all. And you realize that that is truly free. When we talk about... Okay, you're bliss, but... No, bliss is like the old Eskimos, Inuit Indians, seven different names for snow. And if I see snow, I only know one type of name for snow. Snow is snow is snow. But they know snow so much they live in the stuff most of the year that they can perceive different types. It's the same when you get into these jhanas, there's different types of bliss. You get into the first jhana, it's the biggest bliss you've ever known in the world. You're really happy. No, so much bliss. That's why saying the Christians believe it's God. Powerful, blissful. No, if you haven't got the paññā, the understanding, you've got the jhana but not the wisdom, like a Christian mystic, they come out afterwards. Well, what was that? It was powerful, I wasn't there, it must be God. The sense of union there, even in the first jhana, there's a little bit of movement but not much. Good enough to be called one-pointed. I think it's union with God. And it feels like that. That's even the, talking with someone who was practicing under a Hindu guru, Hindu mystic. And he was telling me that sort of, he gets this beautiful blue nimitta, and he's taught if you can absorb into that blue nimitta, that's enlightenment. That's union with Brahma. And actually, because if you know these things, you can tell them, actually, that's not union with Brahma, that's just the first dharma. But Krishna would make the same mistake, call it union with God. And if you get the wisdom, actually, you can understand these experiences on a much deeper level. And basically, that's why Buddhism was amazing, because the Buddha not only got into those states, but really sort of saw exactly what they meant. And sort of gave, and lots of other monks and nuns since have got into those states. And explain them very, very clearly, so you don't get caught up into thinking this is the end, this is enlightenment, this is union with God, I'm a saint. Because if you do that in, you get into first jhana in Hinduism, you go and tell your teacher, you're a saint. And many of the saints in India just got that far. And that was it, saint for the rest of their life. Never have to worry about food anymore. But this is missing a lot of what's really there. So when you actually go from jhana to jhana, you know different types of blisses. What you thought was the most blissful thing in the whole world, you find actually is even more bliss. That's why sometimes, what I said earlier, sometimes you wonder, how much bliss can you take? Because, you know, these bliss states, sometimes, you know, this is actually before you get to the jhana, sometimes you think you're going to burst, you can't take anymore. I like to say those things, it gets people excited, you get so much bliss, you can't take anymore, it's just still there, not just like, you know, most of the pleasures of life are just only there for a few seconds, it lasts for hours, it's, oh wow, can't take anymore, leave me alone, and it gets more, wow, wow, these are different types of blisses. So you're learning about happiness and suffering, what really is happiness, what really is suffering, you've got some types of blisses, but some which are even more blissful than bliss. That's like, I don't know how many of you have studied mathematics, but I always thought that the biggest number in the world was infinity. But that's called, in mathematics, alpha null. And then there's alpha 1, which is infinitely bigger than infinity. And alpha 2 is infinitely bigger than what's infinitely bigger than infinity. It doesn't make any sense, doesn't it? Because infinity must be the biggest number, but it's not. Mathematics can prove that. Same as like jhanas can prove this. What's the most blissful, absolute bliss in the world is something which is even more blissful than that. Even more infinite than infinity. And it's interesting actually that, here we go, I'm just really going off on tangents here, but when we say, you know, I told some of the people that if any of your Christian friends says, oh, Buddha wasn't a prophet, he wasn't even a son of God, you know, he wasn't a God himself, he was nobody. And you go up and say, actually, our Buddha was the teacher of your God. So if you, you know, if you follow Jesus, actually, our Buddha was his father's teacher. They should respect him. Now where that actually comes from, interestingly enough, is one of the places, is the Brahma Nirmantalika Sutta, where the Buddha went out to see this great Mahabrahma called Bhaka, basically the equivalent to a Christian god. And the Christian god said, worship me. He said, I'm not worshipping you, I'm more powerful than you are. I know more. I said, no you don't. I said, yes I do. And so they had this challenge. And the Brahma said, look, I'll show you how powerful I am. I can disappear from you. And the Buddha said, try. And no matter where Brahma could go, he couldn't disappear from the Buddha. The Buddha said, I will disappear from you. And the Buddha did. And Brahma couldn't find him. And afterwards, that proved to him that this monk who had manifested from the human realm into the realm of Brahma actually knew much more than God did. And that actually gave that God the humility to realize it wasn't all-powerful, all-knowing. That this monk knew more. What actually happened there is the Brahma God can go into and out of first jhana, no further. He knew that amount of bliss. But that's why sometimes it's, you know, except that's union with God, that's union where God hangs out in the first jhana realm. That the Buddha could go to second, third jhana. And the Brahma never knew such places existed. Or such beings existed as lived in those realms. Couldn't go any further. It was just completely beyond his perception. Its perception. Actually, in Pali, all of the sexuality gender stops below that realm of the gods. So anyone wants to know, is God a man or a woman? It's an it. There's no gender there. Because it's like you can get in the realms of the mind. So, that's just an aside there, just how these little realms that sometimes you don't realize this other sort of bliss can actually exist, more refined. This is what I was saying about delusion, because you cannot conceive that such states of existence can be completely beyond your conception. So when you get into these places, it's a complete surprise, a shock, that such happiness can exist in the world. Such freedom could exist in the world. And you think you've got it, and then you get another jhana deeper, and you realize, hang on, there's even more to this. And as you go into each different stage of bliss, there's one thing which you should be able to recognize once you come out, that the reason why the bliss gets more and more intense, more fantastic, is because you're letting go more and more. Each different jhana is a higher stage of letting go. Basically, there's less there. And that should give one the insight. What actually, you've already got rid of all the doer. What you're getting rid of now is the knower. Consciousness. This is why I keep on saying that these are the two citadels of the illusion of self. This is what you really think you are. You assume you are. On the deepest of senses. Deepest of levels. And it's almost impossible to overcome that just through will, through thinking, even through belief. Certainly when you have these amazing, weird, but very blissful experiences, can you have the realization, yes, such things actually exist. And you know exactly what they are. All these descriptions are just only approximations. You can never put into words what is a pure mental experience. So what that actually does, it just shows you that even consciousness is impermanent and subject to cessation. Consciousness can stop. As I was saying in a metaphor earlier, it's as if you see the televisions, which have always been there throughout your whole existence, through many lifetimes in samsara. Okay, sure, the programs have changed. Sometimes you've got human programs, sometimes animal realm programs, some deva programs, sometimes hell realm programs on your consciousness as you go through the different realms of samsara. Now you see the whole television disappearing. The knower, the screen on which all this sensory experience is played out, completely vanishing. So when there's emptiness there, there's nothing to know the emptiness. It's not just what's outside vanishes, what's inside vanishes. It's not just letting go of what's out there, it's letting go of the hand which holds all these things and grasps all these things. The whole lot vanishes. So often people think enlightenment is just getting rid of everything out there, but you're still here, being able to enjoy that enlightenment, still preserving the sense of me and mine. That's why everyone says, I am enlightened, is a fool. Because the I has gone. So, this is how these things get the enlightened experience is happening. When you come out of these states, you've got an incredible amount of data. If you've got the framework of the Buddha, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering, non-self, you've got dependent origination, you've got emptiness, you've got all these amazing maps which the Buddha left describing what's going on. You look at that experience, you look at the map back, something disappears. Forever this time. In those jhanas, all the defilements disappear, but only temporarily. You can get into these jhanas and come out afterwards again. And if you're not wise, you can go right back to square one, get angry, get upset, usually after a few days, not straight away, because you're just high as a kite. Be careful, because sometimes people get into jhanas again, think they're completely enlightened, and it feels like it. You've got no defilements at all, you don't care what you eat, you don't care what you do, you're not interested in any sex or any entertainment because you've got so much happiness inside. What do you want with that? Not suppression at all, just a natural, so high, you completely let go of the whole world. And just walking on air, just smiling, nothing bothers you because you've got this huge amount of inner happiness which usually lasts for days. This is why people have these religious experiences. And they think they're completely sort of enlightened. But these defilements, after a while, they start seeping back again. And one catches oneself and realizes, I'm not enlightened after all. So be careful there. But if you actually contemplate what's happened with the framework of Dharma, then sort of an explosion happens on a deeper level. And actually you start to see what is actually meaning. That's the stages of enlightenment, just to go through them very quickly. The simile I like to use is a simile from the suttas of the seven shipwrecked sailors. And it's a beautiful simile of the Buddha. This sailor is shipwrecked, and there's seven types of shipwrecked sailors. One of them, as soon as the ship sinks, he goes right down to the bottom with it. The second one goes down but comes up again, and then sinks a bit and then goes up again. That's the second one, always going up and down. The third one stays on the surface, floats. And the fourth shipwreck sailor, while he's floating, he turns around and he can see the shore. So he's got a hope of safety. The fifth shipwreck sailor, having seen the shore, is swimming towards it. The sixth shipwreck sailor has got so close to the land, he's in the surf, he can actually stand up, so he doesn't swim anymore. He stands up, he's wading to the shore. He's almost there. The seventh shipwrecked sailor is on the beach, under a coconut tree, safe. Completely free. Those shipwrecked sailors, which the Buddha said, the first one is the one who's done so much bad karma, they go straight down. There's lots of those around. The second shipwrecked sailor, they go down, then they go up, they go down. They've got some good karma, they've got some bad karma. It was going up and down in their life, in samsara. Now really happy, now really upset. going up and down. The third shipwreck sailor, because of good karma, a really good person, keeping precepts, generous, compassionate, kind, they stay up. And you have to have that good karma to stay up. To be the fourth shipwreck sailor, who when they slept long enough, eventually look around and actually see the shore. That's the stream winner. He sees the safety from samsara, sees the end of things. To see that shore, you've got to get that jhana, because that's where you see the shores. Once you've seen that shore, you realize, wow, this is happiness, this is peace, this is freedom. Then you start the swimming. Yeah, it might be disappointing to you, but they have in Pali, they call the seka, the learners. These are the ones who've got their L plates. And so you, once you get stream winner, you get your L plates. You're not a stream winner, you haven't even got your L plates yet. You don't know really where you're going. You don't even have got a license yet to drive a car, so you're too dangerous on the roads. Once you get your L plates there, you're on your way. Once you've seen the shore, you're going to swim to it. It's only a matter of time, 7 lifetimes, they say, at the absolute most. You've got to see in the shore, first of all. You've got to see that degree of emptiness. Not just emptiness out there, emptiness in here, right through. That degree of suffering, not just some little part of me which isn't suffering, I'm going to get reborn in that and just be happy forever after. Everything, right the way through. See impermanence, everything goes. A whole lot, right the way through. That's why I call it letting go with a big L with a big G. And a big ETO as well. Let go. Everything. Not just you let go, but you let go of the one letting go as well. Everything gone. That's why I have to unchallenge and say, just empty. Wow. Nothing there. What about the one who knows the nothing? That's gone too. Everything. Sometimes, some of them, one of the monks used to cover, this is called Ajahn Brahm's black hole nirvana. Where everything gets sucked in and nothing comes out again. Pretty good description. So that's jhana, and that's sort of enlightenment and letting go. It's not that hard. If you really are courageous enough, let things go. And of course, you know, you have to give up quite a lot, but you have to die, but it's fun. Okay, any questions?
Can you say that jhana is the manifestation of the Buddha, like Isha,
you can't say it. Well, you can in one sense, because in one sutta, it's called the Hatipadopama Sutta, and it was actually, for those who can see, this was the first sutta teaching which the Arahat Mahinda taught in Sri Lanka, when he brought Buddhism from India to Sri Lanka. And I often thought, why did he teach this one? So many other teachings to teach. And you know what it says there? It says, the footprints of a Buddha. And those Sri Lankans, you know, there's supposed to be a footprint of the Buddha in Adam's Peak, Suripada. In Thailand, there's supposed to be a footprint of the Buddha. In Burma, there's supposed to be a footprint of the Buddha. That's not the footprints of the Buddha. The Buddha says there's 4 footprints of a Buddha. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. When you stand in those jhanas, you're standing where the Buddha stood. So your mind, in that state, in that situation, is not any different than the mind of the Buddha when he stood in those states. Or the mind of any other monk or nun or lay person through history has also been there. Any difference is nothing. So you're actually experiencing what the Buddha experienced under the Bodhi tree. So those of you who like going on pilgrimages, you can go to pilgrimages to India, and they're great, they're really inspiring. If you can't afford it, or you've got too many other commitments, go in the pilgrimage to the 4 holy sites inside. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana. Mm-hmm. That's the inner pilgrimage. You get in those states and you stand in them, and it's real dinky-dai jhanas. Be careful, because a lot of times people, like, they want jhanas so much they manufacture them. Really dinky-dye ones. They last a long time. Then you're standing where the Buddha stood. And that really gives you a lot of inspiration. You get into the heart of this teaching of Buddhism. Not theories, but you're experiencing freedom. That's why the Buddha called those states, he called it Pavivaka Sukha, the happiness of freedom, Sambodhi Sukha, the happiness of enlightenment, Nekama Sukha, the happiness of renunciation, Upasama Sukha, the happiness of calm, the bliss of these things. When I came with Sambodhi Sukha, that's not enlightenment, but close enough, is enlightenment bliss. That's what enlightenment tastes like.
In other words, without going through jhanas or without having any jhanas, one cannot be out of samsara.
Yes, correct.
And it's pretty difficult.
No, it's not. If you really want to, you can. But people don't really want to. They like to have their cake and eat it. They want to be enlightened, but also want their Saturday nights off.
Then what is this Bodhisattva ordeal?
Okay, ask that question tonight.